This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour and our weekly review of all the important news. It's July 5th of 2024. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, hoping that our American listeners had a great 4th yesterday. And here with me in our studio in Edmond, Oklahoma is Andrew Miller.
Hello.
Joining us from Harare, Zimbabwe is Rafaro Manyepa.
Hello.
And in the second half of the show, we will be joined by Mr. Richard Palmer. But we will begin with a look at the Middle East. So, Rafaro, what were some of the stories that caught your eye in the Middle East this week?
Yeah, well, first of all, this is something that Mr. Palmer spoke about. He wrote about it on Tuesday in his brief about how last Saturday, Iran had its presidential elections. If you'll remember, Iran's president at the time, he died in a helicopter crash. That was several weeks ago. And so they've been having these elections there to replace him. Neither of the candidates that were in Saturday's election got more than 50% of the vote. And so there would be a runoff. Those elections, that runoff election, it's happening today. But as Mr. Palmer said in his brief, both candidates who are running, they basically had to be approved by the supreme leader, who's the one who's really in charge of Iran. And we will hear who won the runoff election over the next couple of days. We'll get into it a little bit later with our main story about just what it is that you expect to not change about Iran. The second story is about the German intelligence officer who visited Lebanon to go speak with Hezbollah's second-in-command general on Saturday evening. This is the second time that they have met, and this Hezbollah leader, he urged Germany to put pressure on Israel to stop its aggression, to stop its attacks against Hezbollah, against Hamas. Germany, in turn, made it clear that it backs Israel and its effort to combat the aggression from Hezbollah and from Hamas, even if it means all-out war. But this meeting right here, you know, the question is, why is Germany talking with Hezbollah? What is it doing in Lebanon? What are its interests there? And that's another story, again, that we'll get into a bit more as it connects with our main story for today.
Okay, yeah. So some notable developments there for sure. And then you've alluded to it a couple of times. What was the big story that caught your eye this week?
Yeah, so this happened on Wednesday, and it's that Israel assassinated a second Hezbollah commander in a matter of weeks. That happened this Wednesday. It confirmed that it killed Commander Mohammed Naame Nasser in a precision missile airstrike. Hezbollah obviously is very angry about this. They responded by firing barrages of rockets at Israel. They didn't do a whole lot of damage. But Hezbollah says that in the event of all-out war with Israel, there is no place in Israel that will be safe from them. Israel, for its part, it's typically in defiant mood. Its defense minister, Yoav Gallant, said last week that if war resulted in Lebanon, I love this, he said that Israel would send Hezbollah back to the Stone Age. And I just love that typical Israeli robust standing. They just don't take any kind of nonsense from anyone, especially these days. But you wonder where does Lebanon fit into everything that's happening in the Middle East? Well, Hezbollah is based in Lebanon, and it's been aiding and working with Hamas in its war against Israel. It's been against Israel from the beginning. And Iran is the nation that's in charge of Hezbollah. It basically calls the shots. And it's been working with groups like Hamas and Hezbollah to get Israel to fight a war on multiple fronts. Iran is always working towards the total destruction of Israel. For its part, Israel has responded with equivalent violence against Hamas and Hezbollah. And this, in turn, has resulted from lots of threats from Iran. Hezbollah is beholden to Iran, and Iran is actually doing a lot now, like especially since Israel has been taking out these Hezbollah leaders to dissuade and threaten Israel against engaging in a military operation in Lebanon. And so when we see things like this happen, when we see Israel fighting against Hezbollah or Hamas, we know that Israel is really fighting Iran.
Yeah, so a lot of moving parts here, of course, and as you said, Iran is really behind this all. I wonder if you could take a moment to just put this in the context of Bible prophecy for the listeners and let them know what they could read to better understand that context.
Right, yeah, because when you look at all of these things, it's like, why do we care what happens with Hezbollah? Why does it matter that a German leader is going to Lebanon and meeting with Hezbollah? Why does it matter what Iran is doing? Well, Bible prophecy is what shows us that we need to watch what is happening in Lebanon. And, you know, Hezbollah is in charge right now in Lebanon, basically meaning that Iran is in charge there in Lebanon. But you remember what we said about earlier about German interest in Lebanon, why this German intelligence officer is visiting Lebanon. And what we've said for the last several months about Germany's on the surface seemingly positive interest in Israel, but is really a concerning interest in Israel. Well, all of this is building towards Lebanon's dramatic pivot away from Iran and towards an alliance with Germany. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, he said a decade ago on a Key of David episode, he said that there's going to be a bloody civil war in Lebanon for control of Lebanon, and you're going to see Lebanon and the European power prevail in that battle. See, that's something, you know, you heard it from Mr. Gerald Fleury, you're hearing it now in advance, that even though Iran is in charge right now, even though you've got Hezbollah there calling the shots fighting against Israel, ultimately Germany is going to end up in control of Lebanon. Germany is going to be allied with Lebanon. And Mr. Fleury says that because there's a prophecy in the Bible, in Psalm 83, that talks about a German-led alliance involving several Middle Eastern powers, including Lebanon. But that alliance, it's going to have deadly, dangerous consequences for Israel. It's an alliance that's going to have its designs basically in destroying Israel. And so that's why we watch all of this that's happening in Lebanon. That's why we watch for what Germany is doing, meeting up there. We watch for what Iran is trying to do over there. And again, like you said, there's a lot of moving parts in all of this. And so for anybody who wants to learn more, I highly recommend that you read Mr. Gerald Fleury's article titled Why We Told You to Watch Lebanon. It's on the Trumpet website, and it just breaks down a lot of the prophecies that are involved and gives you the rundown to know what to watch for exactly and what's coming next in Lebanon.
The name of that article, once again, is Why We Told You to Watch Lebanon by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. And we will leave a link to that in the show notes for today's episode for anyone who would like to understand Psalm 83 and the big picture of what to expect for Lebanon and Israel and many of these other powers that Raffaro just mentioned there. Well, thanks very much for that, Raffaro. We move on now to the United States, which Andrew Miller keeps a close eye on for us. What can you tell us about the news from America, Andrew?
Yeah, a bunch of crazy stories this week. The staffing shortages amongst police departments in Washington State has become so bad that the Seattle Police Department is now actively recruiting illegal aliens to become police officers in their city. The U.S. House of Representatives just released a shocking trove of text messages showing Columbia University administrators openly mocking Jewish students for their concerns about anti-Semitism on campuses. So just remember, these are the same people that are very concerned about providing safe spaces for every snowflake who's been the victim of a microaggression, unless you happen to be Jewish, in which case an angry mob can chant death for the Jews. And if you show any concern over that, you're too privileged, and they don't want to do anything for it.
So a slight double standard there.
Very slight double standard. Also, pretty big Supreme Court cases. There have been a number of big Supreme Court cases recently showing that the Supreme Court has tossed out obstruction charges for about 300 January 6 protesters. These 300 protesters were guilty of trespassing on Capitol grounds on January 6th. But since the penalty for trespassing isn't that bad, the prosecutors overextended their prosecution reach and tried to convict them with an evidence tampering law put in place after the Enron scandal so that they could put them in prison for 20 years. Supreme Court came ruled and said that the Enron law is specifically designed for evidence tampering, which they didn't do. Therefore, the charge is thrown out. So this is another example of something that Special Prosecutor Jack Smith is becoming very famous for, just overreaching. Mm-hmm. If he would have gone for a trespassing charge, he probably would have gotten it easily. But you wouldn't have been in prison for more than a few months. He wanted the 20 years conviction. He used this obscure Enron law that really had nothing to do with this case. And now it looks like all 300 of those people, to the joy of themselves and their families, probably will be let off the hook in this case. Mm.
Yeah, so some very notable developments there for sure. And you've got another story that you view as even more important.
Yeah, this is if this happens, it will definitely be one of the biggest stories in American election history. It looks like there's a very good chance that Joe Biden may not be the Democratic nominee this fall. We're watching this story closely. We'll still see how it plays out. If you keep eye on the prediction markets, like the people who bet on these sort of things, which I'm not one of, but I do still like to see what the mood in the nation is. As they're saying, the people betting money are saying that there's going to be about a 79% chance that Biden's going to resign. So either he's going to or not resign the presidency, but pull out of the race.
Right.
So either he's going to pull out of the race or there's going to be a bunch of people out a bunch of money. It's crazy. We talked a little bit last week about just the disastrous presidential debate he had, which has really woken most the nation up to something that the Make America Great Again conservatives have been saying for a while, is that Biden is in a fairly advanced stage of dementia at the point. His mind is starting to go. It's definitely been very, you could start to see, if you were eagle-eyed, a little bit of signs of it in 2020 when he ran, but it's definitely gotten worse over the past 4 years. And so finally, after this disastrous debate, we had the first sitting Congressman, Representative Lloyd Daggett of Texas, who is a Democrat, called for Biden to resign from the race. He's actually since been joined by another congressman, another Democrat, who's come out and said that he should pull out of the race, as well as a former senator, a former housing secretary, a former Democratic National Committee vice chair, and really a whole coalition of business leaders and philanthropists.
I saw the New York Times editorial board as well. They posted an article saying he needs to step out. And that's a powerful voice there.
Yeah, the New York Times has been a big supporter for Joe Biden all along. So, yeah, the New York Times editorial board, there's been Newsweek's been another left-leaning paper that's been at least publishing a lot of articles about people saying he needs to resign. This is actually another Newsweek article where there's a Disney heiress, Abigail Disney. She's the granddaughter of Roy Disney, who co-founded the Walt Disney Company with Walt Disney. She's not a politician, but she has a lot of money, and she donates a lot of that money to the Democratic Party. She's pretty much says that she's withholding all donations until Biden drops out of the race.
Wow.
And there's been a number of other business people saying that as well. So you've now got two sitting congressman saying Biden needs to drop out. Mm-hmm. The editorial board for one of the most powerful papers in America saying Biden needs to drop out. A number like the Disney family and a number of wealthy Democratic donors are saying that, like, we got to turn a profit here. We're not. Biden's a bad investment. He's a bad man. It's like, we're not going to keep throwing money into the Biden administration. I was looking at some history videos on YouTube yesterday, and I keep getting these ads pop up showing Barack Obama himself pleading with me and others to give Biden $5. He said, if all the working class people give Obama $5, he might have enough money to pull this out. So the fact that those ads are still running shows that Barack Obama hasn't pulled the plug on Joe Biden yet. He may. It's going to be about 3 weeks before Biden's officially nominated. So the way the nomination process works in America is once a Democratic Party delegate has pledged his name for you, he can't unpledge his name unless you willingly drop out. So there's really no way to force Biden. He's got enough delegates to be the nominee, so he's going to be officially declared the nominee about 3 weeks from now, unless at some point in the next 3 weeks he willingly drops out, in which case his delegates are free to back someone else. They'll have what they call an open convention. Instead of doing the whole primary process again like they did earlier this year, just at the convention, it'll be like cardinals trying to pick the Pope, where they just all go in a room. They don't lock the door like they do with the Pope, but just debate until they've picked a new candidate. So that will happen if Biden drops out. Now, as I pointed out in a Trumpet brief earlier this week that went out to our newsletter subscribers, really, Barack Obama's reaction is everything. Jill Biden likes being the first lady, so she's trying to keep her husband in office. Hunter Biden has 459 reasons why he'd want his dad in a position to issue presidential pardons if need be. So the Biden, like his kids and his wife, they like the diplomatic immunity that comes from him being president. So they're definitely pulling him to stay. But a number of people in the Democratic Party who actually want to win the presidential election this fall are pulling him to go. Barack Obama's probably the only person Joe Biden listens to more than he listens to his wife. So if Obama says he should go, he'll likely go, and they'll have an open convention.
Yeah.
The most common name I see floated for who they'd rally around is Harris, because she's actually already gone through the primary process and is kind of the person who'd be next up to bat if Biden were to resign while in office. But it really could be anybody's game. But as I pointed out in that Trumpet brief, and more importantly, as Mr. Gerald Flores pointed out in his book, America Under Attack, which we put in the show notes, Barack Obama's really been the shadow president for 4 years now. Anyone who saw that debate knows that the guy who can't finish sentences is not the guy running the country. You've got Barack Obama's the first president in a century to actually stay in Washington, D.C. after election. He only lives 3 miles from the White House. Anyone who drives by his $8 million mansion sees cars pulling in and out all the time as like lobbyists and politicians go there to like get his opinion on things. So he's pulling the strings from behind the scene and will want to continue to do so. If Biden drops out and Harris takes his place, that's big news, because that doesn't normally happen in America where a president drops out last minute. But as far as Obama's concerned, Harris takes orders from him, same as Biden does. He wouldn't want like a Bernie Sanders or someone of that ilk who's kind of like does his own thinking. But this is really, I think the main takeaway from this is like the fact that the entire nation really can see that Joe Biden's not running the country. We had a Trumpet cover story several months ago, showing that this was really Barack Obama's third term. So this is something that anyone that's listened to this program has known pretty much from the beginning, that Obama was running the country. The Republicans have kind of woke up to that fact. Maybe not at the beginning of the Biden administration, but within the first year of the Biden administration, they could see that Obama was running things. Now, even Democrats like Robert Kennedy and the New York Times board, we can really see that Biden's not calling the shots. This is Obama calling the shots. This entire election is really, whether it's Harris or Biden or Gavin Newsom or whoever ends up getting their name on the ticket in the next 3 weeks, this entire election is really a fight between Donald Trump and Barack Obama.
America Under Attack is the name of that booklet by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. We will link to that in the show notes for today's episode. And thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Andrew. We'll take a short break now, and when we come back, we'll discuss some worrying developments from Russia and China and a landslide election in the United Kingdom. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Thank you for sticking with us on Trumpet Hour today. In just a moment, we'll be connecting with Mr. Richard Palmer to learn about the implications of what looks to be a real watershed, kind of an earthquake of an election in the United Kingdom. But first, I wanted to mention a couple of Asia stories here. First of all, on Tuesday, the Chinese Coast Guard illegally boarded a Taiwanese fishing boat and steered the boat to a Chinese port and detained its crew. This boat was near the Kinmen Archipelago, which is Taiwanese territory and it's Taiwan controlled, but it is close to the Chinese coast. The Chinese, of course, claim Taiwan and all of its islands as their own. So they boarded this Taiwanese vessel, and now five crewmen are detained in China. And who knows if or when these people will be released. So this is a big escalation in China's belligerent and illegal behavior toward Taiwan. And it's also a pretty standard example of what's sometimes called salami slicing, because it's just pushing things a step further, possibly to test the waters and see what the response will be. So that means that Taiwan and its partners either need to respond, or they should expect this to become the new norm and for it to happen again and again. Another quick story here about China expanding its network of spy bases in Cuba. The news of China's first spy base in Cuba broke last year, and now this week, new satellite imagery showed that China is building a whole network of these, and they are believed to give China advanced eavesdropping capabilities just about 100 miles from the U.S. coast in Florida and just 70 miles from America's Guantanamo Bay naval base. So very alarming to see China building these kinds of capabilities so close to the U.S. mainland and important bases. But it looks like American authorities don't have any plan in place to put an end to this. And then the last story that I wanted to mention for Asia is about China developing an attack drone with Russia to help the Russians in their war against Ukraine. So one of the major developments of Russia's war in terms of technology has been seeing unmanned aerial vehicles or drones become tremendously important on the battlefields, or I should say in the skies above the battlefields. Drones generally cost probably less than 1% of the price of a warplane or a helicopter. And of course, they don't have a pilot inside risking his life, and they're able to do stunning amounts of damage. Drones also offer reconnaissance abilities, you know, eyes in the skies without endangering a pilot's life. Michael Kaufman is a well-regarded military analyst, and he recently said, "Drones give countries cheap access to tactical aviation and precision-guided weapons, allowing them to destroy the enemy's much more expensive equipment," end quote. So, you know, F-35s and other fifth-generation fighter jets and warplanes, they are not obsolete by any means. They're capable of much that drones still can't do. But those kinds of warplanes are wildly expensive. And drone technology is advancing fast, and it's being combined with artificial intelligence. And this is changing deep-rooted dynamics that have really defined war for decades. And it is dulling the edge a bit of these billion-dollar F-35s and other advanced warplanes. So a big shift is underway, and China is on the forefront of this shift in many ways with their drone manufacturing. And this week, Bloomberg reported that the Chinese are now working with the Russians to develop a new attack drone, somewhat like the Iranian suicide drones that Russia has been using so many of over the last 2 years. Russia has used thousands of those Iranian drones so far against the Ukrainians, and China is positioned to build this new version far faster than Iran or Russia. So it does look like China is increasingly just ignoring the laws that ban countries from giving Russia lethal aid. And it shows that China's support of Russia is becoming a more and more valuable kind of a lifeline, really, to the Russian war machine. And the trumpet keeps a close eye on the deepening cooperation between Russia and China because it aligns with Bible prophecy. We have an article called Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China. This article takes a close look at passages in the books of Ezekiel and Daniel and Matthew and Revelation. And these passages together show that Russia and China will soon be allied together along with other Asian nations, and they'll play a major role in the next world war. So when we see China today working to better arm Russia, that really shows us that the Russia-China axis is essentially here. It's essentially on the scene now. And that article that I mentioned, Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China, it goes through all those various passages and holds them up next to current events. So it could be a good read, I think, for listeners who would like to understand this in that context. Well, we will turn our attention now to Europe and the United Kingdom, which Mr. Richard Palmer keeps a vigilant eye on. What were the developments that caught your eye this week, Mr. Palmer?
German arms exports rose 30% in the first half of 2024. That means 2023, German exports were at a record high. The first half of the year beat that year quite handily. So 2024 looks like it's going to set quite a comfortable new record for the biggest ever year for German arms sales. Nearly two-thirds of these weapons went for Ukraine. Another standout was Saudi Arabia, which is just, you know, that's really interesting. Germany had placed restrictions on arms sales to Saudi Arabia. They were lifted last summer, and Saudi Arabia has kind of shot up the list of recipients of German arms. So this is German militarism rising from the underground. Also, Germany using arms sales as a critical diplomatic tool. And we're seeing that important trend. And then, I mean, this story and our big, I mean, it's all about elections, really, the other stories today. So France had elections over the weekend. Now, for France, this is just the first round of elections. They have a very unique election system where if somebody wins 50% of the vote, they go straight in, they get that seat in parliament in the first round. If they don't get 50%, then all the candidates that got more than 12.5% of votes from registered voters go through to a second round. So we've got kind of the partial result for the French national election. For that partial result, the National Rally, this upstart party from France that they're often called far right, really I think far left would be as good of a description. Mm-hmm. They're kind of a very much a socialist nationalist type party. They won 28% of the vote. The French president, Emmanuel Macron, got his party caught a humiliating third place with 20%. And sorry, it was actually 34% National Rally won. So massive draw towards this Popular Front party, or sorry, this National Rally party. Popular Front, the new Popular Front is this upstart, is a new kind of left-wing group. So anyway, big shift to this fringe party, very dramatic in France. Whether that shift results in power for the National Rally depends on the second round of voting that we'll have very shortly. And in the past, what has happened is the mainstream parties have kind of come together to block National Rally from coming to power. And they've told people, basically, it's the equivalent of the Republicans saying, vote for the Democrats rather than this national rally party and the Democrats saying, well, vote for the Republican. If a Republican party in one of these runoff races is in the pole position to beat the national rally, we'll withdraw, we'll tell our voters to vote Republican. That's the kind of thing that normally happens in France. The fact that National Rally did so well in the first round indicates that that is breaking down. Whether that continues to for the second round remains to be seen. But this trend that we keep drawing attention to of European countries being dissatisfied with the status quo, dissatisfied with mainstream parties, voting for parties that used to be considered too extreme to even be an option, that is on full display in France. And we'll see how big of a difference that makes to French politics very soon.
So a lot to keep an eye on there in France for sure. And then there's also, of course, a big election that just happened a little bit closer to home for you, an election that's being called a landslide and an earthquake. What can you tell us about this?
Yes, it's a simultaneously very interesting and very boring election. I think there's been a lot less election coverage because this result has been predicted for months. It's exactly the result everyone predicted. So there's been maybe less drama around it, but it's quite a dramatic result. So Keir Starmer is now the British Prime Minister. Labour won a landslide. They won 412 out of the 650 seats. That's almost two-thirds of the seats, 63%, one of their biggest majorities in history. So that itself is huge. But I think what is really interesting about this, say, boring election is that they did this with the smallest vote share of any victorious party in post-war history, possibly even in all of British history. So they won nearly two-thirds of the seats. They won only 34% of the popular vote. So and in fact, Labour actually got more votes in 2019, couple of hundred thousand more votes in the last election. 2019 was a massive defeat for Labour. The number of votes they receive falls, yet this time they win by a landslide. That is why I think it's a really interesting election as well.
Yeah, this does seem like a pretty unique, or at least a very unusual situation to have that kind of a precipitous decline in the votes, but yet you have this so-called landslide victory.
It's kind of hard to get your head around. A fall in votes leads to a landslide victory. But what happened is the Conservative Party received their biggest ever defeat in their history ever. The Labour Party, the number of votes they got fell slightly. Like I said, I think it's a couple of hundred thousand. Number of people voting Conservative was basically half compared to last time. Massive fall. Last time they had 365 seats. Now they're down to 121. Half of their MPs, more than half, a lot more than half, gone. So that, I think, is the real story. It's not an election that Labour won. It's an election that the Conservative Party lost. That's the way that a lot of people have been putting it. And I'll just cover some of the other headline parts of the election before I get into the big reason why. Scottish National Party, this party that wants an independent Scotland, they absolutely collapsed. They went from 47 seats to 9. So if you're like me, a supporter of the United Kingdom, remaining the United Kingdom, that's some good news from the election. The Liberal Democrats had their best result since 1923. So Britain, we have this kind of, traditionally British politics has been a three-horse race rather than a two-horse race. Apart from that, the electoral system is very similar to what you have in the United States, a so-called first-past-the-post system, where if you come in first place, you get the representative for that district, rather than it being, say, a proportional system, which is what you tend to have in Europe, where if you get 50% of the electorate, you end up with 50% of the seats in parliament. So the Liberal Democrats, they went from 11 seats to 71. So a massive rise for them. But the big change in the election was the arrival of Reform UK onto the political scene. Basically a brand new party coming onto the scene and winning 14% of the vote and coming in third place. So they actually won more votes than the Liberal Democrats, who had 71 MPs, but Reform UK has 4 MPs. So it all gets back to this whole kind of confusing or complex election. It all just gets back to this first past the post system. So Labour has 34% of the popular vote, but if they're coming in first place in a lot of elections, say they say in one particular constituency, they get 34% of the vote. Conservatives come in second with 20, Reform come in next, say, with 15. The only thing that matters from that is Labour came in first place. Doesn't matter how much they won by or anything like that. The fact that they came in first place. So they're coming in. They may have only got 34% of the vote, but they came in first place in about two thirds of the races. So that 34% of the popular vote becomes two thirds of the seats in Parliament. And it's the Conservative defection to Reform that enabled the Labour victory. So Britain has not shifted to the left. That is not the story from this election. It is not a mass of people who used to be voting for the Conservatives, an on paper right wing party, saying, actually, I'm voting Labour this time. That did not happen. Mm-hmm. Instead, it is people quitting the Conservative Party and voting for Reform. And Reform only came in really a few percentage points behind the Conservative Party in that third place position. So really, what, you know, Britain, we've been in this situation where we've had a Conservative government for, I think, 14 years now. They're on paper, they're a right wing party. They're called center right. Past 14 years, we've seen a very steady move to the left. You know, when it comes to basically, you know, homosexual perversion, to call it what it is, in schools, where it comes to, say, mass migration, both legal and illegal, with just the floodgates being open to migration and everything like that, with DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion in business, and the way that really governments have co-opted businesses to impose a radical social agenda on the entire country, where if you're a white man, your chances of success in finance and a whole host of different industries now, it's very difficult because of government-pushed DEI on businesses. And so the Conservatives come into this election saying immigration is too high, saying business is too woke, we have too much woke policy, saying migration is far too high, we're going to stop it. And kind of the entire country is looking at them saying, you have been in charge for the last 14 years. You have let this happen. How can we trust you to turn all of this back? Because you promised to. Like every Conservative manifesto going back, I think, 30 years has said they're going to reduce migration, and they haven't done it. So, of course, they had this massive defection. And basically, you know, really, the Conservatives are fundamentally a left-wing party these days. That if you judge them by their fruits, not what they say, but what they've actually done, they're a left-wing party. And so I think for a lot of Conservative members, it was a choice with, we can go very quickly in a left-wing direction under Labour. We can go more slowly in a left-wing direction under the Conservatives, or we can vote for a different direction under Reform UK. And I think people have been left with a very difficult decision as to say, well, do I vote Reform UK, or, okay, do I say, well, I don't like the direction the Conservative Party are going in, but at least it's not as bad as the or it won't be moving in that direction. We won't get to that destination as quickly as we would under Labour, so I'll vote Conservative. And that vote ended up being split, which allowed the Labour Party to get in. So it's the rise of Reform that I think is really the story of this election, though the immediate result is we now have a very left-wing government.
Yeah, I'm glad that you emphasized there just how much Britain has moved to the left under the Conservative Party. As you said, the Conservatives have governed for 14 years. And during that time, they've just overseen the growth of all kinds of these woke institutions that you mentioned. They also oversaw very strict COVID lockdowns, a deepening crisis of Islamist immigration, as you mentioned there as well, and then housing and healthcare crises and a lot more. So it's not at all surprising to see many voters abandoning this so-called Conservative Party that is not actually conservative in their practices. Do you think that even though the reformists are gaining more power with a Labour government in place now, do you expect this leftward shift to accelerate?
Yes. Yes, I do. I think... that, yeah, we've Keir Starmer, Keir Starmer's strategy this election was to be boring. So if we think back to the previous election, 2019, Jeremy Corbyn was the leader. Jeremy Corbyn was not boring, no matter what else. Yeah, he was a communist firebrand, basically. I mean, he's right now, he's full on protesting Israel and supporting Hamas. You know, he would invite Hamas and Hezbollah for tea in Parliament. you know, pretty like not a closet socialist, like as somebody who goes and gives speeches about how wonderful socialism is and how he wants to bring that to Britain socially. So I think after that, so Keir Starmer's strategy was to be not Jeremy Corbyn, and that meant being very boring and not saying anything particularly interesting all election camp, because he's got it in the bag. Everyone's kind of disgusted or upset with the Conservatives for one reason or another. All he has to do is be a blank canvas. And he did that very well. But now that means we've got a blank canvas as prime minister. So what are we going to get for Sir Keir Starmer? And I think that's kind of hard to say. You know, In his youth, he was kind of, from what we know, he was quite a lot more radical. There's some 2005 documentary, I think that's a clip from there doing the rounds, where he talks about being made a Queen's Counsel. Queen's Counsel is just a certain rank of lawyer in the UK. And he's kind of like, huh, it's funny that I'm now a Queen's Counsel because I used to advocate for the abolition of the monarchy, which is quite, in the UK, that's quite a radical left-wing position to take and not at all popular. So that's how it used to be. Now it seems much more like his opinions depend on who his audience is. So in the wake of George Floyd's death, he took the knee to Black Lives Matter. He's kind of on the, like, if he's talking to a left-wing audience, fully embraces left-wing transgenderism. You know, women can become men, and I can't define what a woman is. I'm not a biologist, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas if he's talking to a different audience, he'll kind of say, oh, yeah, no, common sense. We want to be polite, but, you know, a woman is a woman and a man is a man. So he has tailored his message to the audience in that way. I think, though, the other big question is, he knows Labour lost votes compared to last time. He knows he doesn't have the majority of the nation behind him. How much of a concession is he going to make to that? Is he going to be maybe not as extreme as he might have been and be more cautious because of that mandate, despite having a massive number of seats in Parliament? You know, it remains to be seen, but I think we can still see several ways that a Labour government is going to be a lot more radical. They're going to want much more money for services. I think Britain has reached this position now where it's a different kind of doom spiral. It's a kind of economic doom spiral where we've got a big bloated government that does tons and tons of social programs. Labour will want to expand that. Where do you get the money from? And they're kind of out of a lot. They promise not to raise income tax. So basically, they're going to have to kind of come with these sneaky tax raises and tax dividends and tax, basically wealth taxes, house price taxes, these kind of things that might look like they're going to raise money on paper, but in reality just push wealthy businesses and wealthy, you know, the most mobile people in society that already pay more tax than anyone else and massively support the government. You're going to push them abroad. You're probably going to get less money in revenue because of those policies. So you're going to have Labour wanting to spend more and struggling to raise the money. And you'll see, I think, taxes get squeezed because of that. We definitely will see, I think, more woke policies, more DEI pushed on businesses. It'll be harder and harder, say, for a white man to find a job. Definitely much more in terms of putting Britain back under EU leadership or resisting Britain trying the EU and Brussels trying to assert control over Britain. So we'll see more of European Court of Human Rights, European Court of Justice being given jurisdiction over Britain. We'll see definitely a lot more of the homosexual perverted movement in schools. That will definitely keep up. A big movement from Labour. One of their key talking points actually has been cracking down on homeschooling. And trying to make homeschooling much more difficult. I don't know if they will follow through on that because they do get a lot of support from fairly radical Muslims, and radical Muslims also like to homeschool. So that might kind of end up cancelling out there. I think definitely a lot more environmental regulation. So I think it's going to be very hard on the British economy. There'll be a lot of brakes on the British economy that isn't exactly doing very well as it is. Maybe as interest rates and inflations fall, they might have some things in their favour on that. And then also illegal immigration. You know, they're not going to be changing course on illegal migration. One of their MPs was just watching a speech where she was talking about how, so what if it means the hospitals are fuller and the schools are more crowded? We need to bring more people into this country. So I think we'll see that. So I think those are fairly reasonable predictions of what you'd see from a Labour government. That's kind of assuming that they don't go into this being super radical. I think certainly the door is open for them to be much more radical and you to see much more than this. But I think we're looking at an economy very much weighed down by regulation and taxes and a pushing of a woke agenda at every level that they can, and a big increase in migration.
So it sounds like some difficult days ahead there for the United Kingdom. What could you tell us, Mr. Palmer, about the big picture of this story and what listeners could read to learn more about that?
Yeah, I think in some ways, you know, it's hard to know. I don't think we can talk about British politics with the same error of certainty as we can U.S. politics.
Yeah.
For the United States, we have a very clear set of Bible prophecies that guide us in forecasting what is going to happen in the United States. And because of those prophecies, we believe America will have a bit of a conservative revival, you could say, that you're going to have Donald Trump return. And that's going to allow some economic prosperity and some freedom so that we can get this message out to a great degree and give the nation one more warning. It doesn't mean that all the problems are going to be fixed, but it is going to usher in an era, a short period of stability so we can get this message out more. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry kind of gave a great summary of a lot of the different prophecies in that, in an article he wrote several years ago titled "Britain and Judah's Governments Fall, America Next." Now, in that article, the news is out of date. Don't worry about that. It's written several years ago after Boris Johnson was forced to resign, but the prophecy is still spot on. And after talking about what is going to happen to America, Mr. Flurry goes on and talks about how you could see similar trends in Britain. So he says, it appears Mr. Trump may have to recover some of Judah's freedom for God's work to even be able to deliver God's message to the cities of Judah. He talks about how during this revival, Amos 7 and verse 8 talks about God passing by these nations one more time. He says God passes by the last time to show three end time nations of Israel, the United States, Britain, and the Jewish nation, how to solve their problems and to warn them of the consequences of their failure to do so. 2 Kings 14:28 comes back and it affects the politics of both Britain and Judah to enable a message to go out. Things get better in both these nations for a time. Could the same thing happen in the UK? 2 Kings 14:28 does not specifically mention Ephraim. It is still part of Israel, and God still has a powerful message to them. These three countries all fall together, but this verse also indicates that God gives all three countries a reprieve from that fall, allowing his message to go out one more time. So he's certainly, Mr. Flurry, in that he's not definitive. And again, I don't think we can be as definitive with Britain's politics, but it does seem logical based on these biblical prophecies that you could have a revival in Britain as well. And perhaps the success of Reform UK points the way to something like this happening. And I think you could see potential with the scale of defeat on the Conservative Party and the scale of desperation they're going to be in the days and weeks ahead. Maybe there is scope for some kind of merger between Reform and Conservative or something like that. Or, you know, maybe even more radical, Conservative Party falls, you have a replaced by Reform, something like that. You have some kind of a crisis that brings leads to Labour going for a fresh mandate, calling for a snap election, something like that. You can see how you could have some kind of Trumpian-like revival in the United Kingdom based on these results as well. So I'm not, you know, we forecast based on Bible prophecy. The prophecy says that Britain and America have very similar trends. It says that they're going to fall together. That could mean that you could see some kind of revival together as well. But I would really point you to that article, Britain and Judah's Government Fall, America's Next. Look, even if we don't know for sure what's coming to Britain, that really does give you a great overview of God's plan for all three, Britain, America, Israel, all three of these descendants of the biblical nations of Israel, and how he really wants to reach and warn these nations, and how there's much, much worse punishment than anything a Labour government or could inflict on Britain or what's going on in the United States. Much worse punishment is coming if we don't heed that message. So really, I think that message and what God is doing to reach these three countries and what God is doing to really reach the world, you know, that's the most important thing to understand and learn about. And we may not know the details of exactly how this plays out in Britain, but overall, that message is going to get a powerful opportunity to go out again.
That article, once again, is called Britain's and Judah's Governments Fall, America Next. It's by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, and we will leave a link to that in the show notes for today's Trumpet Hour episode. Listeners can easily access it there if you just go to thetrumpet.com, click on the Listen tab up at the top of the page, and then you'll see Trumpet Hour there. And you'll find links in our show notes there to all of the other articles and pieces of literature that were referenced on the show today as well. Well, we are now coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Please email any questions or comments you may have about today's episode to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much once again to our panel, Andrew Miller, Rafaro Manyapa, and Mr. Palmer. Many thanks also to Parker Campbell for taking care of all of the audio work for today's episode. And we thank you, the listeners, once again for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.